From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. History suggests the Roman Emperor Nero played a mean organ. In the medieval era, the great pipe organs of Europe drew crowds to God. Mozart called the organ the king of instruments. A century ago, American towns and cities prided themselves on local pipe organs. Even department stores used them as a draw. And then organs fell off the map. New York Times reporter Craig Whitney was a boy organist. As a longtime foreign correspondent for the Times, he has followed his obsession with pipe organs around the world, from Europe to a bamboo organ in the Philippines to cathedrals in Vietnam. Now a senior editor at the Times, he's pulled a lifetime of pipe organ love and lore into a new book that brings back a grand history. Tonight on Point, we're diving in to the Pipes of Majesty. Joining me now from New York is Craig Whitney, assistant managing editor of the New York Times, amateur organist and organ builder, and author of the new book, All the Stops, the Glorious Pipe Organ and Its American Masters. Good evening and welcome, Craig Whitney.
Good evening. Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. So there it is, your instrument in all its glory behind us. What are we hearing right there, Craig?
Well, that's an early 18th century German organ built by Gottfried Silbermann. And it was restored 20 years or so ago by a Dutch firm. It's an organ that Bach could have played, but probably didn't. At least we don't know that he did. But he enjoyed the organs that were built by Gottfried Silbermann. And on those organs, this kind of music, this is a chorale prelude that he wrote, sounds glorious.
Sounds glorious indeed. Give us the story, Craig Whitney, of how you came to carry an obsession with organs around the world. You've been a foreign correspondent for the Times all over the place, in Saigon and Bonn and Moscow, London, Paris. And it seems that everywhere you went, you carried this with you. Why and how?
Well, the thing about organs is they're not like pianos or violins. They're not standardized instruments. So every one of them is completely different from every other one. And it's just fun to go around the world if you have this as a hobby or an obsession and hear what each one of them sounds like. Now, that one we just heard was in communist East Germany when I first was stationed there in the 1970s. And it was kind of a trek to get to it and an adventure. They also didn't heat the place, and I was able to play that organ, but it was so cold in the cathedral when I was there in November that it took about 20 minutes for my fingers to warm up enough to really play, and I had to admire the old Bach and those guys for the fortitude they must have had to be able to play these things. It's things like that that you pick up when you tour around the world and see them.
So here was just one of many treks to organs that you took. What year would that have been in East Germany?
That was 1974.
So this was still deep in communist East German era. And what kind of story would have taken you to proximity to this particular organ?
Well, I have to admit that I arranged that whole trip around pipe organs because back then I had just come from Saigon, where I was a war correspondent for the Times, and I didn't really know much about Germany or certainly East Germany, so I didn't want to tackle a subject that was above my head. I thought, well, why not pick something I know? And I knew there were these historic organs there that not many people got to play or hear about, so I asked the East Germans to arrange a trip for me and talk to organ builders there at the time and some organists, and then I got to see a bit of the country that way. Had an interesting experience, in fact, because the windshield of the Peugeot car that I had broke in the middle of Dresden. And where do you get a Western car windshield fixed in Dresden in November?
Well, there's no Jiffy Lube or Mr. Goodwrench around.
No. And my communist guide, probably she belonged to the Secret Service, took me to a little garage where a guy took the car in and jury-rigged a plastic windshield that held all the way the 200 or 300 miles back to Bonn. Well. So it was an interesting little insight into an aspect of life you didn't hear about much in communist East Germany.
Adventures along the way. You note in the foreword or introduction to the book, All the Stops, that wherever you've reported from in the world, you've made this habit of seeking out the local pipe organs, writing about them. You took a lot of ribbing about this from your journalistic colleagues, a lot of it bawdy. Whitney's organ, the stories would be named, and it would always be Whitney's organ being squeezed, cut, shortened, or otherwise painfully maltreated. But you say that really points to something, which is that for most Americans these days, even now with the revival that's gone on to some extent, an interest in pipe organs and pipe organ music is, in your word, an eccentricity.
Yeah, it's partly that. Partly, of course, it's just so easy to make bad puns with the word organ in them. But it is true that most people think of the pipe organ as a kind of bizarre curiosity. And if you're as interested in it as I am, they think you must be a little bit eccentric, so they want to make fun. But my purpose in writing the book was to try to show that the organ was once much more generally, broadly popular than it is today, and try to understand a little why and see if there was maybe a chance of getting it back towards the musical mainstream or classical musical mainstream.
There's a real American drama in the middle of that story as well, but maybe it's good if we understand the history a bit first. When was the real golden age of the pipe organ, Craig Whitney? And was it the same in Europe and in the United States?
No, I'd say the golden age in Europe was probably, the 18th century, Bach's time, maybe a little before. Certainly in North Germany and in Holland, that was the high point of the musical importance of the organ. And this, of course, was in the days before electricity. These organs were completely mechanical. It took men to pump air for them. They were hugely complex, but they made beautiful music. They were the most complex things that human beings had devised, except for clocks at that time.
You write, and I had no idea, that the history of the organ goes very deep to something predating an organ, 3rd century B.C., evidence of a hydraulis in Alexandria in Egypt. An early form of pipe organ that used a water pump. How did that work?
Well, I'm not much of a mechanical engineer, but it used water basically as a way of maintaining air pressure. So it wasn't a bellows that produced the air pressure, but water in a closed chamber, which squeezed the air in it enough to produce air under pressure to make the pipes speak. This, of course, was Greek Alexandria in Egypt, but it was a Greek civilization. And these things were apparently fairly widespread at that time and in the Roman Empire. And even the Emperor Nero supposedly enjoyed playing the hydraulis. The great American organist E. Power Biggs joked once that if he had had his hydraulis with him when Rome was burning, he could have put the fire out instead of fiddling.
Instead of his fiddle. Where would Romans have gone to listen to their organ, the hydraulis?
Well, they'd play him at, the games in the Circus Maximus, outdoor events, always. It wasn't a religious instrument. And in fact, in the early Middle Ages in Europe, it apparently was not used in church services either. Exactly how it became a liturgical instrument is not very clear from the historical record. It may have just been a device that priests and monks used to summon people's attention, make a loud noise, get them to be quiet, and then they'd start a church service.
You describe it almost like the noonday whistle played one way or another in gladiatorial contests in Rome, and then by the early medieval period used to call people to the church or get their attention in the church. But by that 18th century golden ear that you describe, it had become, in your description, one of the most complex creations of European civilization and the focus of some of the most brilliant artists of that time or any time.
Well, probably the greatest composer of music for the organ ever was Bach, whose contrapuntal music, which weaves different melodies together in harmony, comes off beautifully clearly on organs of that type that he knew and played on.
There's a Bach piece behind us right now. I think this is the Prelude and Fugue in C.
Right.
Thank you.
That's the organ in Weingarten, which is in southern Germany, in the Swabian part of Bavaria. And it's more or less from the same period as the one we just heard previously in Saxony, but it reflects a little more French influence than the Silbermann organs do. It shows you that part of Germany back then was an area where different cultural influences came together, including in such things as pipe organs.
When these great composers turned to the organ, what was it that they were turning for? They had options. They had many instruments they could look to. In the literature of that time and the musical writing of that time, what do they leave us for insight into why the organ, what they found in this instrument? Mozart, you're right, described it as the king of all instruments. What drew them to the organ?
Well, you can only surmise. I mean, Bach's music is of such surpassing beauty that he obviously was looking for the effects that different stops, different tonal qualities could make in the interweaving of different melodies in harmony. It's also, it makes a great noise. You can make a louder noise, you can make a softer noise on a pipe organ than you can on any other instrument. It's really like an orchestra in some ways, always has been. And I think that has appealed to composers over the years. And people like Mozart, Bach, and Handel wrote pieces for a concerti for organ and orchestra. And you create a sort of dialogue between the pipe organ and the orchestra. It's the variety and it's the unique fact with an organ that as long as you hold the key down, the note keeps sounding. It doesn't fade out. So you can play with that, and especially in a building with a resonant acoustic, as most churches in Europe had, that creates a great effect.
I'm thinking that in the 17th, 18th, 19th century, in Europe, in a cathedral with a grand pipe organ bellowing, this must have been one of the most engulfing oral experiences that people ever had anywhere in their lives.
Well, probably, and it's awe-inspiring, so you can see why it suited religious purposes to, you know, get people to come in with reverence and respect and a little bit of awe of what they were hearing.
You're right about Bach, a profoundly Christian believer, understanding some of his work on the organ as a statement as impressive in its domain, you say, as Newton's Principia, or perhaps later Einstein's theory of relativity in physics. Again, all-encompassing, all-engulfing, even intellectually.
Yeah, that referred in the book, I was referring to the great Passacaglia and Fugue in C minor, which I had first heard on E. Power Biggs playing on the organ at Symphony Hall in Boston on a recording. I played it so often that the needle of my little record player eventually kind of wore through the end where it gets very loud, and it sounded like a B-29 by the time I got finished with it.
You know, the organ is so austere and lordly. What's your sense of how ordinary American ears hear it today? Can people generally still respond to it?
Right.
But what's the visceral response that the contemporary American ear has to this great instrument?
Well, it depends on what you play on it. You know, I've heard some concerts that were a lot of fun and that the audience really enjoyed and laughed over, where the organists were playing orchestral transcriptions, Sousa marches, that kind of thing. So you can have all kinds of different effects. It's just like with an orchestra. You know, the organ can be funny, it can be ridiculous, or it can be sublime and very serious. It all depends on how you play it and what you play on it.
We'll go out into the break with Craig Whitney, our man, playing the organ at the American Cathedral in Paris himself. We're talking tonight about the history of the pipe organ. Craig Whitney's new book is All the Stops, the Glorious Pipe Organ and Its American Masters. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with New York Times longtime foreign correspondent Craig Whitney about his new book, All the Stops, the Glorious Pipe Organ and Its American Masters, the history of that grand instrument in Europe and in the United States. He, as a correspondent, has chased down organs all over the world and played many of them, listened to more, and relates that both that history and his intrepid relationship with the organ in the book. Craig Whitney, we heard you playing yourself in the American Cathedral in Paris just before the break there. How did you end up at that keyboard?
Yeah, I mashed a couple of notes there, too. You can tell I didn't hide anything. Well, I was stationed in Paris for 5 years between 95 and 2000, and Ned Tipton, the organist at the cathedral, was kind enough to let me practice there regularly, and I did a few recitals as well.
We hear behind us right here, will you tell us?
That's the organ that's built also by Carl Joseph Riep, who built the organ at Ottobeuren in southern Germany. This one is in Dijon. Riep knew what he was doing, and sort of like me, he also enjoyed Burgundy wine, and he settled in Dijon, in fact, and he eventually made more money selling and growing wine than he did building organs. But this one he built in 1745, and it was restored a few years later. I went there to enjoy the Burgundy wine, but also to hear it after it had been restored by a German organ builder, and some of the French felt that he'd made it sound too German.
And what did that mean?
Well, you can tell the difference between, you know, a North German organ just sounds very different from a French organ, even from the same period in the middle of the 18th century. That's because they grew up in different liturgical traditions and to different tastes. In those days, Europeans were more different from one another than they are today. I would say, you know, you could simplify and summarize it by saying that a German organ is more clear, brighter sounding, whereas a French one tends to be more mellow and darker sounding when you pull on reed stops that are imitative of trumpets and that kind of thing.
Craig Whitney, give us a quick tour of the structure of a grand pipe organ. You write that, of course, they can have thousands, even tens of thousands of pipes. How does this thing work, and what's the range of elements that come into play physically in bringing us this sound?
Well, here we can sort of get into what happened in America once they discovered electricity. But if you go back to the 18th century to a French or German organ of that period, it would have several keyboards, and each one of them controlled a set of pipes behind the keyboards and above them. Mm-hmm. The pipes are what make the sound. You press a key, and a system of levers goes right up to just below the pipe and opens a valve that lets air in. That's how the pipe makes a noise.
So you've got a central source of air that's ready to be directed through any of these pipes.
Right. In those days, it would have been one or two bellows assistants stamping on big bellows to make the air under pressure. Nowadays, it's just an electric motor that produces pressure. And all those little knobs on either side of the keyboards that you see on an organ, those are the stops. Each one of those knobs controls as many pipes as there are on the keyboard. One pipe can only produce one note, so you have to have a different pipe for each note on the keyboard for every stop. And when you pull out the stop, then that allows air to go into the pipe when you press the note under it.
And you'll have a range of pipes from very slender, maybe pencil-sized even, all the way up to big tree trunk diameter.
Right. Well, the low ones that rumble and thunder can be as long as 32 feet. And the high ones that almost sound like dog whistles, almost above the range of human hearing, those are an inch or less long, or at least the speaking part of them is an inch or less long. So when you look at an organ in a church or a concert hall and you see maybe 15, maybe 30 pipes visible, what you don't realize maybe is that behind those are hundreds or thousands of pipes, and those are what together can produce the different variety of sounds that an organ makes, but also the tremendous volume. When you pull them all together, it's very powerful.
Take us into the American history here. The Puritans at first rejected pipe organs as the devil's work, as you say, but eventually the Congregationalists and Unitarians relented. Organs came into the United States and became extraordinarily popular.
They did, and in the mid-19th century, they started building organs in municipal concert halls around the country. There's a famous one in Mechanics Hall in Worcester.
Massachusetts.
Right, one of the first of them. So it became not just a church instrument, but also something that could play secular, popular music when the town or city involved didn't have the money or the time or whatever to summon a whole orchestra and pay them. You know, it's a lot cheaper to pay an organist to play something that sounds like an orchestra than it is to hire a bunch of orchestral musicians. I think that's maybe one reason why this became popular. And eventually, the organ builders found ways of using electricity to make organs even bigger. The thing is that the more pipes and stops you have on an organ, the harder it gets to play if you try to couple them all together. Physically, it just becomes very difficult. Well, they, Ernest Skinner and other builders developed ways of using electricity to do the work instead of just a mechanical connection. That also allowed the organist to be situated not necessarily right up there under the pipes, but 20 or 30 or even farther feet away.
When did electricity get connected to organs?
Towards the end of the 19th century, and then beginning in the early 20th century, American organ builders and those in other countries too went to just doing it with electricity. Electricity became the thing, and you began to get the development of huge pipe organs of hundreds of stops in some places that you couldn't have played before, at least not with all the stops drawn, because of the limitations of mechanical connections. The price they paid for this was that, you know, mechanical connection direct between key and pipe is more responsive to the player's sensitive touch. Electricity is, you know, E.P.R. Biggs used to rail about it and say it's a fine way to ring a doorbell. It's no way to play a musical instrument. I think he exaggerated, and I find that electropneumatic organs that are properly maintained and well-built can be exquisitely musical. And a famous company in Boston, no longer existing, but the Aeolian Skinner Company, produced some masterpieces, one of them the one at Symphony Hall that's being restored now.
We want to get into that conflict of Biggs and Fox, but before we get there, what was the sort of cultural, social peak of the organ's popularity in the United States? When and in what venues?
In concert halls, certainly. In the teens and 20s, believe it or not, there were 10,000 people at an organ recital that Edwin Lemaire, a famous British organist, gave in San Francisco around 1920.
Sort of rock star popular.
Just about. He was playing orchestral transcriptions, not just Bach, although he also played Bach very well. But it was entertainment music that got these huge crowds to come to places like the Municipal Auditorium in San Francisco, the one in Cleveland, and other such places.
And once they were electric, you write that they're in churches, restaurants, stadiums, nightclubs, all over.
Right. And you had, of course, theater organs in every movie house before movies had soundtracks. You had to have an organist there to kind of accompany the action on the screen. The Wurlitzer Company built hundreds of those all around the country. Only a few of them still survive. And rich people who could afford it and had houses big enough to put pipe organs in had them. And they had player roles, like player pianos, so that they could crank those up and listen to music being played for them. The organ was almost as popular as the piano in some circles back in the early 20th century.
Let's hear just a bit of that. Here from a 1929 Skinner organ. This was in a private home, in a mansion called Elm Court in Butler, Pennsylvania?
In Butler, Pennsylvania, right. It's a player organ. That's a tape that's playing, and it's Chabrier's España. An organist would have trouble playing it that fast, but it sounded great on this organ that Ernest Skinner built.
for some captain of interest industry, presumably, and I don't know, is that Steel Country, Pennsylvania?
It was an oil company, actually, Magnet, who owned it. It's now, again, privately owned. It was Benjamin Phillips of the Phillips Gas and Oil Company who had it built in 1928, and it's now owned by a man named Koch, who has allowed it to be recorded and sometimes does private concerts on it.
Oh, what a fun time sitting around home on a Saturday night with this player organ bellowing away.
Absolutely. It's up in the ceiling of this beautiful sort of neo-Gothic mansion, and you can hear it all over the house when it's playing.
And then, Craig Whitney, you describe a kind of civil war that comes into the American organ community. Describe that for us.
Well, as organs became used electricity and electro-pneumatic playing connections between the keyboards and the pipes, they became more and more orchestral rather than classically Baroque the way the organs of Bach's time were. And eventually there came a counter-reaction to them. It started in Germany in the early 20th century, and it really took root in America in the 30s. Mm-hmm. One of the influences in the reaction to the orchestral organs was G. Donald Harrison, who later headed the Aeolian Skinner Organ Company. But Harrison never went as far as some others, like Biggs did, who began to feel that orchestral organs were really parodies of what an organ should be.
And what made an organ orchestral rather than, I don't know, the old original?
Well, you would put lots of pipes in chambers that had louvered shutters on the front of them so that you could, with a pedal, open and close the louvers, which would make the sound swell like an orchestra can and then go back to a softer effect. And with many, many stops that deliberately imitated orchestral instruments so that you could play basically symphonies on the organ and play transcriptions of orchestral work. Whereas the classical organs of Bach's time, though they also had stops that imitated orchestra sounds, usually sounds of orchestral instruments that no longer exist except in pipe organ specifications.
Behind us, you can hear the Franck Grand Pièce Symphonique. It's played by Daniel Roth on the Cavaille Cole organ at Saint-Sulpice in Paris.
Yes, Cavaille Cole was the French orchestral organ maker par excellence. He built organs that allowed composers like Franck to write symphonic pieces, pieces of symphonic dimensions for the pipe organ. The reaction to this came, as I say, in the United States in the began in the 30s, but it strengthened in the 50s. And eventually you had people like Biggs saying, we had to go back to building organs the old way, not with electricity. Let's just use mechanical connections. Let's make them even be tuned the way they were in the Baroque time, not evenly, but emphasizing certain intervals instead of others. You can't play all kinds of music on an 18th century organ. Try to play a chromatic piece by Vierne on a French Baroque 18th century organ. It sounds terrible because not all keys play tunefully to the ear on it. Some keys are better than others.
So he said, let's go back. And you had, as you describe it, Craig, really, really two men who came to personify this conflict, E. Power Biggs on the one hand, Virgil Fox on the other. Describe these men for us, these organists.
Well, Biggs was British. He came to the United States on the make. He wanted to make himself a concert organist, and he did. He was one of the most successful we ever had. And he lived in Cambridge all of his professional career and bought the classically designed and sounding organ that's in the Adolphus Busch Hall at Harvard. That was the Busch Reisinger Museum for a number of years. And that organ had a great influence. It caused a lot of organists and other people after 1958 when it was installed, to do what Biggs did, build organs the old classical way. And he influenced American builders like Charles Fisk of Gloucester, the C.B. Fisk Company is still thriving up there, to do the same.
And the old-fashioned way, again, I want to be sure I understand, it would still be electric, but the connection to the pipes would be mechanical. Is that right? So that
the only
source of air would be electric? No one stomping on bellows?
No, although the American builders have built organs that have bellows, too, if you want to operate them that way.
Wow.
All in the...
wonder what that pays.
All in the name of authenticity.
Right.
But the main thing is the connections between key and pipe are mechanical in these organs. Now, Virgil Fox didn't believe in all that. He wanted to express himself on pipe organs with romantic music and thought that the Baroque people were fussy fuddy-duddies. And he was the main counterweight to this movement towards authenticity. He sort of led the organ into a last romantic heyday. He did the kinds of things that Lemaire and others had done with transcriptions. But he also played Bach. He took Bach on electronic organs, which Biggs wouldn't play. Fox took an electronic touring organ into rock venues like the Fillmore East in New York and played Bach to kids who were probably mostly stoned. But
and a fairly romantic figure himself. You describe seeing him wearing a scarlet-lined cape and the white tie outfit, the whole shebang.
He wore the cape even when he was in the Army in World War II. He wore it over his uniform, and one of his
that could get you beaten up, I think, I fear.
Right. One of his colleagues asked, "Why are you wearing cape over your uniform?" And Fox said, "Honey, they see you before they hear you."
Yes. But at heart, what the conflict here was then about whether the organ would become a modernized electronic instrument or whether it would go back, or at least the organ community would sustain the old way.
Well, that's the way some of the proponents and opponents put it. But I think it was really an argument between two ways of seeing the organ. You know, one is as a musical instrument that can express itself perfectly and as smoothly and with as much dynamic range and ability to swell and do diminuendo and so on as an orchestra could. In other words, the organ as an orchestral kind of instrument versus the organ as what it was in the Baroque era, which is a contrapuntal instrument capable of making beautiful music of one sort.
Mm. We'll come back in a moment and hear how that conflict was resolved. Behind us is the E&GG Hook Organ at the Church of the Immaculate Conception in Boston. We're talking with Craig Whitney, a lifelong organ fanatic tonight. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking tonight with New York Times Assistant Managing Editor Craig Whitney. He's also an amateur organist and organ builder. He's out with a new book, All the Stops, The Glorious Pipe Organ and Its American Masters. Craig Whitney, you were just describing then these sort of opposing camps, the electric organ supporters, the mechanical organ supporters. How did this conflict resolve itself? Has it? And what was the collateral damage along the way?
Well, I guess the biggest collateral damage was that the Aeolian Skinner Organ Company, which built organs with electro-pneumatic action and beautiful ones, but of orchestral dimensions, went bankrupt. It at first tried to build Baroque-sounding organs using electro-pneumatic devices, but they didn't really understand how to do it. And then we had the growth of a number of companies. There's now around 50 of them in the States, C.B. Fisk maybe being the most influential, that did learn how to build organs the classical way and did so successfully that they've now even started branching out, some of them, into making organs that are just as capable of producing orchestral sounds as Aeolian Skinner's were. They did one at the Meyerson Symphony Center in Dallas, which has been hugely influential in concert halls around the country. So it changed the nature of the organ building industry in America. It's now more boutique industry than a mass production industry.
But you write that organs are coming back, roaring back.
Well, I think they are, although not in numbers the way they were in the 20s when, you know, as many as 2,000, 3,000 organs were produced per year. Now it's more like a couple of hundred, but they are exquisitely made and wonderful to play.
Here is the organ you mentioned, I think, in Dallas, the Fisk organ at the Meyerson Symphony Center?
Right, that's that one. Mary Preston playing Louis Vian. Louis Vian was a great organist who died at the Console of Notre Dame in Paris in 1937, I think it was. He came to the United States in the 20s and did concert tours, and he also drew audiences of thousands of people to his concerts. But he was amazed at the things he saw in America and enjoyed the organs here.
But as an organ lover, then, you're at a moment where you can see a kind of comeback going on, boutique and not anything like the numbers that there were, but great organs being made and installed again. Are there more coming?
Yes. For instance, there's a great new organ being planned. It looks amazing for Disney Hall, in the home of the Los Angeles Philharmonic in L.A. Frank Gehry designed the facade, and it looks like an earthquake has hit it already.
Oh, boy, I can just picture that.
Very avant-garde design, but that's only one of many. There are other important developments, like, for instance, the restoration of the organ at Symphony Hall.
In Boston.
Right, which was last restored and changed by Aeolian Skinner in 1949. That's being restored now by the Foley Baker Company. Severance Hall in Cleveland got out of mothballs, more or less, the organ that Ernest Skinner had put in there at the end of the 1920s. Concert halls around the country are, except here in New York City, alas, are reviving their pipe organs, and I'm sure that they'll be heard often in the future.
So give us a couple more of your escapades into organ country around the world, Craig Whitney. There was a bamboo organ that you tracked down in the Philippines.
Right. I went to that bamboo organ in the 1960s when I was there in the Navy. It's a Spanish-influenced organ from the early 19th century, and most of the pipes are made out of bamboo. It later came to Bonn when I was stationed there in the 70s to be restored by the Kleiss Organ Company, so I've heard it in both Germany and the Philippines. It went back to the Philippines, and I hope it's in good health now, although termites were a problem for it. One of the organs that I really enjoyed going to play when I was a student in Boston in the 60s was that one we heard briefly, Tom Murray playing at Immaculate Conception in Boston. That's a great organ built by a famous American company, the E&GG Hook Company. And it is, as Murray's recording calls it, an American masterpiece in a beautiful building with a resonant, fine acoustic. And I'm glad that that organ has been saved at various times in the past. The Jesuits weren't sure they'd be able to keep the church open, but I understand it's safe now, so that's a beautiful one.
You found organs in Catholic Saigon as well.
Yes, there's a little pipe organ up in the balcony there that it's kind of hard to hear because the organ's so small. It's a 19th century small French organ that an American contractor paid to restore back in the 70s, the early 70s, when I was stationed there as a Times correspondent. But the trouble is that being in the tropics, the cathedral's open to the outside, and there's a lot of traffic that roars around the cathedral all the time. So between the bats that fly around in the balcony and the sputter of motorbikes that you hear in the background, it's a little hard to hear the organ play.
Craig Whitney, they're great tales, and still I'm left wondering where this instrument's going. You quote in the book Ken Cowan, an organ virtuoso, just a boy when E. Power Biggs died, asking, how can any human being sustain interest through 15 minutes of organo pleno sound? There may have been a time 300 years ago before people had heard synthesizers, marching bands, radio, television, and rock concerts when audiences might have been captivated by that loud commanding sound. Now, that's just one sort of organ sound, but is the organ up against a kind of cultural evolution that is going to leave it behind, or will it always be there as a period instrument that's so enmeshed with church and history and culture that it won't go away?
Well, I think certainly organs in liturgical churches have found a place that they will always have. I think that the organ could become a more popular instrument than it has been in recent decades if organists would stop trying to recreate historical performances so much as to engage with the audience and play the music they might enjoy hearing. I think organists have begun to do that. What Ken Cowan was alluding to there is that he, for instance, plays beautifully transcriptions of orchestral music on romantic electro-pneumatic organs mm-hmm. that have been restored in various places around the country. But he's criticizing the school of thought that says, no, you should only play organs strictly the way they were in the 18th century and not do things like orchestral transcriptions. Well, I've been to concerts in places like Merrill Auditorium in Portland, Maine, where the organist played nothing but transcriptions. Mm. That may be an exaggeration, but the audience just loved it.
Craig Whitney, it's been a great tour. We're going to go out tonight with what I think is the largest playing American pipe organ anywhere, at the Wanamaker Grand Court Organ, now at Lord & Taylor Department Store in Philadelphia, something like 29,000 pipes here?
Yes, and thousands of them imitate the string section of an orchestra. That's what you're hearing now. There are more than 28,000 pipes, and the organ weighs 520 tons. It's a beautiful instrument. It's being marvelously restored and kept up, and it plays every day. They open the store with it at 10 o'clock.
Fabulous. Here with Peter Richard Conte playing Nimrod from Elgar's Enigma Variations. Craig Whitney, we thank you for this tour of terrain we don't get too often. Thanks for doing the book, and thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you so much. I hope I've won a few converts.
Craig Whitney is assistant managing editor of the New York Times. He's author of the new book, All the Stops, The Glorious Pipe Organ and Its American Masters. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
Iowa, I love you.
The people of Iowa tonight confirm that they believe in a positive, uplifting vision to change America.
We're going to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan. And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House!
Yeah! My career in public office is coming to an end, but the fight is never over.
I've had the military leadership at the top as well as at the bottom. So that's what it is. He was a lieutenant in the Navy. And I was a four-star general in the Army.
And their efforts, their enterprise, and their character, the American people are showing that the state of our union is confident and strong.
The goals are central to our struggle for peace and human dignity. Yet, in the past year or two, the war in Iraq and other events caused our attention to drift dangerously away from them. It is time to rebalance the international agenda.
There's a week, Senator John Kerry thanks Iowa voters for delivering him a big win with Monday night's caucuses. Senator John Edwards places a surprisingly strong second in Iowa. Former Governor Howard Dean finished a disappointing third. He responded to that defeat with a head-turning howl and a week of soft-spoken contrition. Representative Dick Gephardt drops out of the race after his deep fourth-place finish in Iowa. General Wesley Clark, campaigning in New Hampshire, pulls rank on the front-running Kerry. President Bush says the State of the Union is confident and strong in his annual address before Congress and at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland today. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan warns that the U.S. narrow focus on fighting terrorism could worsen global tensions and harm human rights. Jack Beatty, there's a week.
It's a week, and really it's a week of stump speeches, isn't it? I mean, the President's State of the Union was an out-and-out stump speech.
No question.
It was as if he were running in a Republican primary. I mean, there was red meat in there for the social conservatives, a little hint about a constitutional amendment, possibly.
On the gay marriage front.
On gay marriage. And there was a lot of red meat to the Steve Forbes libertarians. We're going to make these tax cuts permanent. And there was no effort, I thought, that would really surprise me. It was as if he were running in a primary and wasn't worried about the middle. And he sees it was like the Democrats. They're not worried about the middle either. They're going right for their
well, but he was
base.
Sprinkling right through the State of the Union speech, Jack, references to new potential for health care coverage and social issues that might make him once again have that compassionate conservative posture in the eyes of the middle.
Yeah, but when you start to look at the details of this medical that are subsidies that he's talking about, mm-hmm. there it's picayune. It's a mockery given the size of the problem. But it's true. He used those words. But I was just struck by the other part of it. I'm getting my base out. And look at how few Democrats applauded him. I mean, usually, you know, in State of the Unions, there's a convention. The other side gets up, and not this year. It was a good stump speech. And in Iowa, now in New Hampshire, we've heard a lot of them. Kerry and Edwards, someone's called them the Blair Democrats, people who supported the war, and the one who opposed it, Dean, lost, and he seemed to lose around the issue of electability. But, you know, I really think he made a big strategic mistake. He never turned his anti-war position into an electability issue. In other words, he's the only one who could go to Bush and talk about the deceptions about the weapons of mass destruction.
This
and the
being
rest.
Howard Dean.
That's Howard Dean. Mm-hmm. And he never made it in those terms. It was almost as if he's giving himself a moral luster with it. I was right, and I saw these things. He didn't make it an electability issue.
It is striking, Jackie, even now, as things push ahead, the Democrats still not really savaging George Bush in general. George Bush standing in the well of the Congress and being very, very tough. The Democrats still somehow not as vigorous in their critique of this administration.
No, they're not. And I think partly they've been distracted by each other. And they've been taken aback, I think, by the Iowa voters' reaction to negative campaigning, maybe even against the president. Mm-hmm. So this is a new turn, I think. It's like they tested negative, didn't work.
Howard Dean eating crow all week long with that 16 seconds of growl and howl after his defeat or third place finish.
But, you know, in the 1964 presidential campaign in New York, the reporters were making a lot of noise outside an event, and Lyndon Johnson rushed out on the stage. He said, "You hush!" And people just froze, and cameras fell. Then Johnson went backstage and did what he was doing. Of course, today, that would be italicized and shown endlessly on cable TV and psychoanalyzed and so on. We're in a new media environment here. One of the cable TV groups, networks, Fox, is a subsidiary of the Republican Party. They can show these things night and day. And the other one, CNN, is a mindless institution. It's in the business of chasing, you know, auto wrecks and Michael Jackson. And all it knows is how to do this tabloid stuff.
Nothing important exposed or seen about Howard Dean in those seconds, Jack?
Nothing in proportion to this orgy of italicized repetition on these cable networks. Nothing at all. I take his point that he was rallying and trying to console his young supporters. There's no question about it.
It at this point is mixed for disco and not likely to go away anytime soon. And then Kofi Annan today before Davos men in Switzerland saying, "Hey, step way back, folks, here and get the big picture here. We've got to look out for fundamental issues around the world or we're just going to have terror and counterterror and violence unending. Let's get a fix on this picture."
Yeah, occasionally we hear this big picture. We heard it from Tony Blair a couple of years ago, reminding us of the context of this war on terror, world poverty, desperation, humiliation.
And there it is, Kofi Annan reminding us all. Next week, New Hampshire, it's big. Jack will be there to cover it with you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.